I hate to admit it, but he's enormously quick and sophisticated and devious. Anyway, I've taken care of him, and he'll take care of teacher, and you'll take care of duty. You've really ensured this? Fight him and win, Harry. Call it payment for the arm. You sound surprised. You found yourself murmuring, almost more surprised with yourself than with her. Warrior proud of the third house. Ride forth now, as my sister. There was a rustle from her side of the bed, and you saw that she had sat up a little, her exposed and metal-skinned humerus garishly propped on the covers. "Was that poetry?" she demanded. "Debatably," you said, and she lay back down. Then you said, "I accept your help. I am forced to admit that I cannot do this alone." "I live for your forced admissions," said Ianthe. "It would have been a pain if you'd said no. I've already organized everything." You both fell silent. The canopy of the four-poster bed obscured the fresco on the over-decorated ceiling, which was a relief to the eye. Her covers were softer than the covers in your room, though you thought the mattress too squashy for real comfort. One sank down into it like a bog. You were not used to so many pillows, nor were you used to the slippery chill of satin on your skin, nor were you used to hearing someone else's breath insubstantial beside you. For a moment you thought Ianthe had fallen asleep. Then she said idly, "Corona Beth and I spent 3 nights apart in all our lives, and the second time she cried so hard that she threw up. I hope she's sleeping easy now. When she doesn't, she gets bags under her eyelids you could carry water in." It seemed as though a response was expected, but you did not want to speak of dead twins. You simply said, "I have always slept alone." "You don't say." You heard the primness in your voice when you said, "I'm betrothed to the locked tomb, Tridentarius. I slept on a cot in my cell." "I always forget you are an honest-to-God nun, and 6 years old to boot, if you listen to Mercy Morn. How old are you really, Harry?"
18, and my tolerance for Harry wears thin."
18, she said, in the tones of the jaded, fagged-out socialite. "I remember being 18.
"You are 22.
"It's a universe away from 18. You lay in that bed like a marble sculpture, your body remote and far away. Sleep and safety had blunted your panic, but not arrested it wholesale. If Ianthe reached out to touch your arm, you were afraid you might not understand whose arm she was touching. You were so afraid she might touch you. You were so afraid anyone might touch you. You had always been afraid of anyone touching you, and had not known your longing flinch was so obvious to those who tried it. But she did not touch you. Instead, sleepily, she asked, "Do you really keep all those letters on you?" Since you were living in exile from your room, they were now tucked into hollow capsules within your exoskeleton, the location of each of the 22 locked into your memory like so many theorems. You'd tried just tucking them into your robes, but you'd rustled.
"Yes," you said, and did not elaborate.
Then she startled you by asking, "Any regrets, Harrow Hog?"
"About?"
"About any of this. Going to Canaan House, becoming a lictor, coming to the Mithraeum." You were not at all certain.
"No."
"No, I suppose not," she said thickly. "You were more far-sighted than I was. Me? I've never regretted anything as a rule. Good night." For a long time in the darkness,
You wondered at that. Her good night hanging unanswered. You were more far-sighted than I was. It was the easiest compliment to you that had ever passed her lips. You did not set store by compliments. It was vanity to accept them, and patronizing to give them. But this one echoed in your head. You were more far-sighted than I was. You looked at Cyrus the First's cavalier before you closed your eyes, though not to appreciate her details. You were more struck by the idea that she must have died back at Canaan House, when the work was finished, when the Lictoral Theorem had been cracked. Her necromancer had brought these ghoulish remembrances on purpose. He had surrounded himself with pictures he had painted of him, and of the cavalier whose soul now fueled the battery of his heart. You were lucky that the memory of your own cavalier did not hurt you, except sometimes in the form of a sick headache in your temples, or in words stuck on repeat in your head. Some of those words were eating at you now, and you recited them to yourself in the quietude of your brain. Warrior proud of the third house, ride forth now as my sister. Ride we to death and the proving. Ride we with heads held high. We shall bloody our blades in the foe's heart. Death shall we bring to the foul ones. Death shall we win for ourselves as the prize for our high deeds done on the ash-choked plains of the ravens. Book 11. Matthias Nonius and the Cavalier Secondary of the Third House would proceed to destroy a whole legion in exhaustive detail, after which the grievously injured daughter of the Third had to be carried over a thanagy-irradiated desert, while Nonius mused aloud on the nature of fate all the way into Book 12. You fell asleep. By the next afternoon, an envelope had been slipped under Ianthe's door. It was paper of a deep, creamy brown and sealed with wax. When Ianthe broke it open, you peered over her elbow at the contents. A single page, also real paper, also dyed a creamy tan colour, lettered artistically in flawless handwriting and deep blue ink. Augustine the First, Lictor of the Great Resurrection, founder of the Court of Coniortus, first saint to serve the King Undying, requests the honour of the presence of his youngest sisters, Ianthe the First, eighth saint to serve the King Undying, and Harrowhark the First, ninth saint to serve the King Undying. Dinner will be served at 1/2 hour past evening commencement. Attire, formal or ceremonial dress. Your head pounded with a tedious recognition. No, you said. Ianthe tapped your shoulder with the invitation in her usual parody of playfulness, which was a little like being battered around by a predator while still alive. This is the plan, Harrowhark. Just sit back and watch my teacher work. You said, I do not understand the faith you place in that man. It was no good. You would have preferred a time that was not hours hence. You would have preferred a plan that did not involve a formal invitation, a dress code, or dinner. The last dinner you had attended had not gone exactly to plan, and you thought another dinner in poor taste. But you had not reckoned on your roommate, who, as a princess of the third house, thought of dinners the way you thought of morning orison. I still have my robes of office, you said, as she tore apart her wardrobe, fingering each article therein before tossing it aside. It's no longer your office, no. No. It's technically correct. Not this time, my child. I'm sick of being associated with a half-snapped stick of licorice dressed in a tent. No. Hideous. Not even Corona would wear that. No? No. My shirt and trousers will suffice, then, beneath my Canaanite whites. Even worse, said Ianthe, and wrestled from its housing what appeared to be a full tulle skirt in midnight purple. Skirt and woman scuffled momentarily before she heaved it across the room. No. Yes. For a different and much better party. No. No. Sometimes I think the Emperor of the Nine Houses favours you because you've got the same taste in clothes. God, what's this? That's a bit risque. You grew desperate. Let me pick. Ianthe looked at you. Her blue and brown eyes were beatific. Harry, she said, and she said it tenderly. Have you never read a trashy novel in which the hero gets a life-affirming change of clothes and some makeup, and then goes to the party and everyone says things like, "By the Emperor's bones, but you're beautiful," or "This is the first time I have ever truly seen you," and if the hero's a necromancer, it'll be described like, "His frailty made his unearthly handsomeness all the more ephemeral," etc., etc. The word mule 15 pages later. The word nipple 1 page after that. You said emphatically, "No." Then we have no shared point of reference. Thankfully, however, this is not that part, she said. Not even one of the Emperor's fists and gestures could give Harrowhark Nonagesimus a sexy makeover. Sometimes I think you look like a twig's funeral. In the right light, though, oh, this might do. It's even your colour. Come here. She was holding a mass of black fabric, but no black such as ever existed in the house of the locked tomb. You approached with naked horror. Ianthe shook out a long piece of starry sable stuff and held it against you. It appeared to be some sort of enormous handkerchief. It was not a dress. When you pointed this out, she said, with some asperity, Valency Trinnet was my height, weighed more than both of us put together, and, judging by her portraits, had a body that did not quit. Your body, by comparison, gave up at the starting line. Take off your clothes. Take off your clothes was an imperative you never thought you would obey. You did not take off all your clothes, but you consented to strip down to your shirt sleeves, because the shirt was long. The exoskeleton provided some coverage, though not remotely enough for comfort. You stood there with your chin thrust out, expecting a steady flow of crude japery, but all she said was, "Will you take off that grotesque skeleton corset?" "No." "What about your face paint?" "No." "I do not know why I ask these questions," she said. She wrapped the scarf around you, pinned it, grunted, then took it away. You were left to sit on her bed, eating one of the apples she had not yet used for practice. As you ate, you watched her, and you reread the invitation while, typical of a flesh magician, Ianthe took out needle and thread and quite happily occupied herself with sewing. She pronounced it very easy, actually, to thread the needle with her defleshed hand. Written on the back of the paper, "My room, 10 minutes beforehand." "Try this on," she said eventually. It amounted to little more than a veil. She pinned it over one shoulder and left both your arms chilly and bare. The material was water-thin and slippery. When you emerged from behind a gaudy screen, she cinched the black, scintillating stuff tight to your body. It was not true black, but shot with a deep chemical indigo, and as you looked in the mirror, the shade made your eyes lightless hollows. Above that field of navy black, little white scintillae trapped inside like luminescent filaments growing in a charred corpse, your irises were devoid of any colour at all. Ianthe circled you, tugging and pinning, and you suffered it only because her touch was disinterested and clinical. Neither the touch of her living fingers nor her dead ones lingered. It was as though you were simply her patchwork corpse. You would have been impressed at her craft, except that she dismissed your compliments. This is nothing. Naberius could embroider you a full overskirt without pricking a finger. This might have veered close to sentiment had she not added, I wish killing him had given me his needlepoint, too. Your sister licked her, brushed your hair, and fluffed it out with her fingers. It was long enough to do this. Only a little while ago you had shaved it down to stubble. It had taken fright and regrown at speed, terribly afraid that this was your lone symptom of Lictor regeneration. You had not cut it since. You would not let Ianthe fill any of the holes punched in your ears with metal earrings or pearls, and you refused all other jewellery, not bone, and so there was not much else to be done. When she finished, you did not look upon your reflection with revolted shock, merely with a dull and uncomfortable distaste. The worst part was your sudden resemblance to your mother.
I am very satisfied, pronounced Ianthe.
You said drearily, I look like an imbecile. You look just good enough that I'm proud of my handiwork, but not so good that I'll be consumed with lust and ravish you over the nut bowl, she said. I walked a fine line, and I walked it admirably. Go and fix your paint. Your skull's dribbly. As an act of meaningless rebellion, you applied the sacramental skull of priestess crushed beneath the new-laid rock, the least beautiful skull in the canon. When you came back, she was smoothing her hair at her dressing table with a bone-backed brush. She wore a gown of achromatic purple, pale and almost grey, like the smoke from a fire banked with lavender, and made of what appeared to be a few layers of gauze. The back was open, and you could see the fine dents of her spine, her bleached skin bluer and sweeter against the pallid gossamer, and the twin blades of her shoulder blades looked strangely nude and vulnerable to you. She said languidly, Button me up. And you obeyed by sprouting three skeleton arms from the bone-impregnated inlay of her chair, glad to hide her vertebrae. Ianthe wore her Canaanite robe over her shoulders, but did not slip her arms into the sleeves. You were glad for the feeble, diaphanous cover yours offered. She buckled her rapier belt loosely at her hips. Your two-hander you carried on your back. As you followed your co-conspirator down the habitation corridor to Augustine's rooms, a prickle of anticipation washed over the insides of your stomach. Just as your rooms bore very little resemblance to Ianthe's, Augustine's rooms bore no resemblance to either yours or hers. His interiors were of dark wood. Floor-to-ceiling bookshelves ran up most of the walls, and the floor was not tile, but deep plush carpeting. It was a much more crowded, lived-in room, and on every surface was a book, or a stylus, or a folded pair of socks. There were baroque leather armchairs with pale wheels on the arms and seat from years of sitting, and tasteful paintings with wooden frames and a general smell of wood polish and book glue. It was a friendlier room than you had expected, in so far as you had expected anything. The wide tapestry sofa was thick with fringed cushions in comfortable disarray. There were vases of eggshell-thin ceramic on the table set before the vast plex window, currently hung with primrose drapes, shut, filled with, though you had no idea where he had procured them, cut flowers in shades of orange, red, and gold. The saint of patience was bent over a mirror above a wooden washstand, wearing a suit of antique make beneath his robe. You were grudgingly impressed by the sight of a historical artifact actually being worn. Black trousers, black jacket, a plain white shirt with a high white collar, very starched. Augustine had combed his hair into a flat cap against his skull, faultless and shiny, with not a strand out of place. Within the collar sat a funny little black tie that was cut in a curve, and he was knotting it into a fat bow. "Nicely done, my dove," he said jocularly to Ianthe, taking her hands and kissing them. There was a tightness around his concrete eyes that belied the good humour. "You put me in mind of a statue of some lost goddess, hauled up from the waters, painted lineaments removed but marble intact." "Covered in moss, mould and gunge," she suggested, consenting to be kissed on each cheek. "You should see my sister."
"You always say that," said Augustine.
He looked at you and relieved your mind by not kissing you anywhere. He simply raised his eyebrows and said,
"And so the crow can be a swan. Ah, this is like the old days. You should have seen the shindigs we pulled off when we dared congregate. We partied as though it were the days before the apocalypse. I will remember them always. John laughed more then, mostly at that madman Ulysses and Cassiopeia, under the table because she'd had a single glass of wine. All right, kiddies, shall I tell you how we'll play this?"
You asked, "Why are you helping me commit murder?" He checked his little tie in the mirror again, corrected some imperceptible skew, and straightened up.
"For reasons of my own, dear girl," he said, with the glacial cheer that seemed to be his first line of defence. "Once upon a time, if my younger brother had deemed it fit for you to exit this vale of tears, I would not have stopped him. But I admitted long ago that Autus no longer listens to anyone. He always did get his own bizarre obsessions, and you could never get them out of his head with a pneumatic drill. He has caused me more pain over these last scant 40 years than I dare to admit. No, there's no question of me barring you here. I'll get teacher's undivided attention. You'll both skedaddle. Harrow will finish her bloody business, if she can, which I am not at all sure of."
"She can," said Ianthe, ruining it with "probably." And the lictor said,
"She can try. I once watched that man fight a city. The city didn't win. He'll leave the dinner first and be in the training room afterward. That's his habit. You'll leave on cue."
This seemed nonsensical to assume. You said, "He'll leave."
At the same time, the Princess of Ida said, "On cue." "Won't tell you what it is. If you're waiting for it, our Emperor will smell a rat. Just believe me when I say that when I want Autus to go, he'll be giddy gone."
This did not make much sense to you as a joke.
There was a brisk knock on the door. You immediately pressed yourself to the wall, out of direct sight if it opened, and Ianthe tightened bony fingers on the shining end, pommel of her third house rapier. But Augustine merely said,
"Come in, linchpin."
The linchpin walked in. It was the saint of joy. Your erstwhile teacher ignored you, folded into your alcove, and she ignored your sister, whose pallid eyebrows had shot up so fast and so far that they were in danger of breaking the atmosphere. Mercy Morn wore a long slip of peach-coloured silk, and her white Canaanite robe was tucked over her forearms and had slipped entirely off her slender, aggrieved shoulders. She had scraped her hair into a merciless and shining coil at the back of her head, and she had no eyes for either of you.
She said, "You have some nerve."
"Not remotely. I never have," he said affably. "Do you accept the terms of the offer?"
"Tell me what your—"
"Accept first."
"I'll accept if you swear on the sword," said Mercy, with unholy eagerness.
He raised his rapier up within its scabbard. It had a bright conical hilt of what looked to be copper, with pricked designs all over it.
I swear by the sword of Alfred Quinquay, best of men and cavaliers, that the details of your business will not be told by me, or revealed by me, or let fall from the lips of my mouth nor the pads of my fingers, even though I think it will be the death of us," he added. At this, there was a fractional relaxing of Mercy Morn's frowsled brow. Not relief, but the germination of the seed of relief. "Accept."
"Fine, I accept," she said.
Then she looked around herself and said,
"You do know the children are present. Should I kill them, or what?"
"Ignore 'em," said Augustine. "Better you don't know why they're here. Look, I need you to fully commit to this one, Joy, and if you don't, I will consider the oath I just swore tampered with."
"Commit! Commit!" she said scornfully.
You noticed she was wearing short strings of apricot-coloured seed pearls in her ears. They vibrated as she folded her arms across her chest.
"Stop wasting your breath and tell me the plan."
"Once you hear it, whatever you do to me, don't do it below the neck. None of my other shirts are pressed."
"Stop drawing this out. Tell me."
He cleared his throat and said, "Dios apiti minor." You had a front row seat to Mercy Morn's dreamy eyes going quiet. The eye of the tempest, before she reared back and punched him full in the face. There was not much force in that blow, which barely snapped his head back, but he whitened as though her fist had been a battering ram. He gagged, doubled over his washstand and ejected a mouthful of teeth, a tumbling, plinking bowlful. He held his hand over his red and dripping mouth and closed his eyes, and after a few moments straightened back up, a trifle greyer, running his tongue over his regrown incisors. "Minor," he repeated when he could, taking out a handkerchief and dabbing his mouth. "Minor. How many times must I say it?"
"You've lost your senses," she said unsteadily.
"You think I am joking, Mercy Morn?" They looked at each other. Then followed the type of conversation you had only seen once before, between her and God, that exchange of shrugs and words begun in the mouth and aborted at the first breath, and at one point she said,
"Gradient,"
and he answered, "Radial," and then they devolved again into a shorthand of facial expressions. In its own way, it was swifter and less coherent than what you had seen pass between the Emperor of the Nine Houses and her, that lifetime ago leaving the Erebos, but at the end, her hand fluttered around her mouth, and she halfway wailed,
"I'm not wearing the right dress."
"It's perfect. You look like a melon."
"But I hate this," she said, quite genuinely,
and Augustine looked at her with his insubstantial eyes and said, "I understand. Buck up, Joy. It won't kill you." Your gaze met Ianthe's. She had followed the whole thing in rank fascination. Now she quirked her own eyebrows at you in what you had come to understand was, who knows? For a moment you worried that, come another myriad, you and she might be able to carry on such a conversation, that you would know her intent by the twist of her mouth and her exhalation, to the point where you could speak without dialogue. In the end, Mercy Morn said,
"Blech!"
and turned on one heel and stalked out. She flung open the door, said anxiously,
"White wine!"
and with that cryptic epigram, disappeared. The Saint of Patience said, "That went significantly better than I thought it might," without a glance at his sink of bloodied teeth. "Come on. I want one of you on each of my arms on this battlefront. On my right, Ianthe. I'm not clutching that bone. I never did like him skinny. Harrowhark, you really didn't get any height, did you? Lord, imagine being crystallized a teenager forever. Whatever you see tonight," he added, suddenly serious as the grave, "do not get involved."
behind his back, as you walked down the corridor, the Princess of Ida mouthed at you smugly. Quick, sophisticated, devious.
Chapter 30. It turned out that Augustine the First, saint of patience, founder of the court of Coniortus, genius of the river, 10,000 years old and oldest among saints, quick and sophisticated and devious, had a shrewd plan to assist you in the murder of his dutiful brother. His shrewd plan? To get everyone profoundly drunk. 2 hours later, you sat amid a pillage. The remains of a meal lay before you, more than you had ever eaten of your own volition. You'd had to. The only other option was unconsciousness. A pyre of candles cast their radiance across the snowy white linen and the silver cutlery that the saint of patience had so carefully set, and on the crumb-strewn plate that had once contained rolls of some description. But they had been eaten, or put somewhere. You did not know, and you didn't care. The shining bones of cohort heroes hung as silent observers on either side of the room, and you fancied weariness in their eyeless expressions. You were not sure how it had happened. It had seemed to begin as all previous dinners had, just more formal. Maybe Augustine's cooking was more careful and more lavish. He tended to cook in short bursts of violence, serving many parts of a meal but not all at once, which, coming from the Drearbur table, you found bewildering. You hadn't been able to focus on what you were eating, only that by the third course you had to continue or suffer the consequences. You did not really like the taste of wine, which Augustine had served you before, and had not imagined there could be that much of it. He refilled the glasses before you ever finished one, so that you never made it to the bottom of the first. Now, in the smoking ruins of dinner, he and the saint of joy and God and Ianthe had moved their seats to a cluster at the end of the table. Ianthe's first house robes were somewhere on the floor, and her elbows were on the tablecloth, and her cheeks were pink, which gave her a spurious loveliness. Augustine had removed his jacket and was sitting in his white button-up shirt. The tie at his throat had come undone entirely to hang limp and black beneath the points of his dishevelled collar. Mercy had it worst. The knot of hair at her neck had come down and now was springing loose in pale rose-gold strands, and she was actually sniggering. God sat between them. Teacher had his sleeves rolled up to his elbows. If it was a tidier or nicer shirt than he usually wore, you could not tell. The coronet of bones and leaves had fallen from his brow, probably in among the napkins, and his top button was crooked, and every so often he would come around and fill up everyone's water glasses and say with increasing earnestness, "Keep drinking water, Harrow," as though water were the greatest and most impossible boon granted to the nine houses. His smile kept crinkling the edges of those white encircled eyes. Every so often, you would look over the table at the man you intended to kill. The saint of duty had drunk just as much as Augustine, but had an expression like stone, with not a button out of place. He had more than once shared a glance with you that you were very afraid was solidarity. You weren't sure. You were drinking water. You were drinking a great deal of water.
"To absent friends," said Augustine suddenly, and raised his glass. And everyone said, "Absent friends," and raised their glasses and drank.
That was the invention of torture. You had no doubt that either the third or the fifth house had come up with the damned rule that whenever you raised your glass and proposed a sentimental toast, everyone had to drink with you. You sipped. You did not have any absent friends.
"And to our cavaliers," said the saint of joy quite suddenly,
after everyone had drunk.
Augustine raised his glass again.
I'll drink to that. To Cavaliers. We didn't deserve them, and they didn't deserve us, as I always say. To Alfred, Christabel, Hera, Loveday, Nabirius, to them all.
You saw the Emperor darting an impassive glance at the increasingly disarranged saint at his right, but she did not greet this toast with anger. She simply said, "To Christabel," and drained her glass in one single violent motion. When God briefly pressed the tips of his fingers to the tips of her fingers, she said instantly, "I'm not drunk."
"I'd never think it," he said.
You watched Ianthe take another swig of the pale, apple-yellow liquid in her glass. She leaned over to you and murmured breathlessly, "This is the greatest night of my life."
"I've drunk enough to Alfred's over the years, so let me drink to Christabel," said the saint of patience. And he drank, and then he swirled the contents of his glass meditatively. "Here's to Christabel."
Mercy said, with less rancor, "You never liked Christabel, even before what happened."
"Bullshit, I didn't like Christabel," he said instantly, with the careful, measured reasonableness of a man you had personally seen get through two bottles of wine. "You know what I feel. You know I don't think she was the best influence on Alfred. You know I thought they brought out the worst in each other, and I don't think you disagree."
God said, "They were very similar people."
"No," said Augustine, "they weren't, John. She was a fanatic and an idiot. Yes, she was Mercy, and he was a man who regretted that he wasn't. It took surprisingly little to lead my brother astray."
"Nobody could lead him where he didn't want to go," said God, and his patience took a solemn edge. "You know that."
"Lord, don't tell me that," said his lictor, faintly smiling. "I have built an entire myriad on the idea that I could have made him come around, given 5 minutes."
His sister saint said nothing to this. She flicked her eyes down to her own glass instead, and he quickly filled up the awkward pause with,
"Anyway, let's drink to a woman who never divided opinion. Here's to Pyrrha Dvay."
All eyes trailed fatally down the table to the saint of duty. Your gaze was among them. You grasped the stem of your wine glass in your hand, and you looked at the face of the man who had been necromancer once to a woman called Pyrrha. The inscrutable lack of expression that had greeted you in the bathtub, and the first time he'd walked into the Mithraeum's chapel. He said flatly with a note of warning,
"Augustine."
"I mean it. Don't you think that's astonishing, after all this time? Even Mercy doesn't have a bad thing to say about her."
"Why am I constantly painted as a critical person?" came the inevitable critique.
"I say, here's to Pyrrha, the woman I cultivated a smoking habit to impress. The Cavalier, the Legend, the Stone Cold Fox. John, please stop joggling my elbow. I have heard Stone Cold Fox from your own holy lips."
The Emperor protested.
"Respectfully, respectfully,"
Autus said.
"Another topic."
"Right," said Augustine.
He took another gulp of wine, as though to fortify himself, and Ianthe suggested, "To our enemies, older brother."
"Yes, great," he agreed heartily. "A classic. This is why you are my chosen apprentice, chick. To our enemies, the enemies of the Empire, to those safely in the river, that is. I won't drink to enemies alive, but let's drink to enemies fallen, as we can afford to be gracious. Let's drink to the dried-up blood of Eden."
Both the Emperor and Mercy said immediately, "They're not gone."
"Fine, pedants. I drink to the best of them. Gone for absolute certain, not the remnant kooks, idiots and zealots who think a nuclear missile could give us pause. The commander would never have settled for a nuclear missile. Lord, that was a merry dance she led us. It deserves something. Perhaps
it's a toast.
Across the table, you noticed that the Saint of Duty's knuckles had clenched just slightly. You had a good sense for knuckles. The Emperor mistook your focus for puzzlement. It was before you were born, Harrowhag.
Long before you were born, added Mercy, owlishly. Because you are 3 years old.
This isn't really a story that deserves to be told after 3 glasses of wine.
That was never 3 glasses of wine, said the man to his left.
4 glasses of wine, amended God, which was probably still inadequate. This is a good lesson for you girls, not to underestimate anyone. A quarter century ago, these fanatics found out about the resurrection beasts, which are classified to the upper echelons of the cohort mind. So that was an intelligence effort and a half.
They knew about them, said Ortus. They just didn't know what they were.
Finding out what they were didn't stop them. They searched one beast out, threw away half their ships, separating a herald from the pack. Killed that herald. Let's drink to that.
To killing heralds, said his 2 elder lictors, and they drank, and so did Ianthe, and you put your lips on the glass.
Even a dead herald can drive a necromancer insane. They took that thing apart. They made it into knives. They made it into axes. They made it into armor. I mean, extremely frugal, but honestly, that commander had herald bullets.
Bullets, said Augustine. Darts, throwing knives, dead shot. Got me right between the eyes once. Mad as a cut snake, and 3 times as vicious. We nearly lost you to her a few times, didn't we, Ortus? Should we drink to Commander Wake?
The glasses rattled as the Saint of Duty stood and said the most words you had ever heard him say.
Probably not. Excuse me. I'm tired.
They watched him go in pursed-up silence. Teacher rose from the table silently, as though thinking of going after him. When the door shut behind the escaping lictor, Mercy Morn hissed,
Augustine, you ass!
And he protested calmly,
He's fine.
You call that fine?
Sudden access of sympathy, a little uncharacteristic, when
not difficult to imagine that maybe...
Don't, said God, sitting back down with some difficulty. Don't. Not when you're finally talking again. This is more amicable conversation than I have seen you two exchange in... It must be decades. Don't. I've had a very nice evening. Harrow, you haven't drunk too much, have you?
You had drunk exceptionally too much, and were dying to purge your kidneys manually.
No,
you said, at the same time that your seatmate said,
Very obviously, yes.
Nobody asked you,
you said, but Ianthe was moving her chair over, and she was slinging her living arm around your bare shoulders, which made them feel less bare and less cold, which you resented, and she was saying,
There, Harry.
God repressed a smile at this vile nickname, for which you once again assured Ianthe slow death.
Let me introduce you to the special world of sisterhood. I will reveal everything you do, contradict you at every turn, and hold back your hair in the morning.
You did not want Ianthe to reveal everything you did, nor did you want her to contradict you at every turn, and you especially did not want her to hold back your hair in the morning. But God said cheerfully,
Here's to sisters.
And the other lictors reached for any glass that contained anything, and you had to take yours, and they pressed it into your hand, and you drank. Augustine said,
To sisters, and the women we've left behind.
God's mouth was cheerful as ever, but his eyes were not when he said,
Do I have to drink to that?
For the first time you were witness to the Saint of Patience discombobulated.
Apologies, John. Wasn't meant as a jab.
It doesn't hurt any more, most of the time, said God,
and he was still smiling. The lictor at his left was combing out her hair. It tumbled in a heavy mass around her shoulders, that curious heart of a yellow rose colour, that pinkish, reddish, goldenish shade that was not entirely appealing. Her glass still had wine in it, which seemed unrealistic, and she said,
"Here's a better toast. To the Emperor of the Nine Houses. To the Resurrector. To my God."
"To Emperor John Gaius, the Necrolord Prime," said Augustine, and he drained his glass. This was the only toast you were willing to drink to. You drank because you held to your convictions, and also because Ianthe was looking at you with the mocking and faintly pitying expression of someone who did not expect you to drink. This made you drink twice. "I'm not going to drink to myself," teacher was saying. "I'm not the best man who ever lived, but I'm not quite that much of a narcissist." The saint of joy said, with uncharacteristic ferocity,
"You are the best man who ever lived."
"I'll drink to that," said Augustine.
You could not behold God's expression for any great length of time. Augustine stood, and he refilled his glass, and he refilled Mercy Morn's. He clinked his wine glass against hers with a little crystal tinkle. She beheld him with dim and unfeeling eyes, and they drank in silence, at either side of the Emperor of the Nine Houses. Eventually, she said,
"I think I wish Kitherea were here."
"I don't," said the saint on the other side. "We would have had to suffer her favourite conversation of who had the hottest cavalier, and my answer hasn't changed for anyone's money. I don't care that she was 10 years my senior. Pyrrha de Vay was hotter than the very fires of hell."
"Agreed," said God.
"John, you dog!"
"An absolute bombshell," said God.
He looked deeply into Augustine's eyes, took another slug of wine, and then said in graveyard tones,
"Though maybe not quite such a bombshell as your mother."
It destroyed some cavern of your reverence to watch Augustine punch the Prince Undying on the arm, and to watch the Prince Undying gamely cuff him back. Part of your brain temporarily calcified into atheism.
You had not thought it would be like this.
From the day the letter arrived in Dreaber, you'd thought that your literal days would be spent in prayer, training, and the beauty of necromantic mysteries. You did not think any part of it would be spent honestly quite drunk, wearing a piece of material no larger than a towel, and with Ianthe Tridentarius's fingers idly caressing the hair at the nape of your neck. For a moment, you wondered wildly if you had hit your head quite hard entering the shuttle out of Dreaber, and had hallucinated everything subsequent. Mercy Morn said peevishly,
"I always thought Nigella was prettier."
And both men assured her, "You're not wrong. Good choice, etc." Until Augustine said gloomily, "Try getting a look in with Cassie around, though." You turned your head and muttered into Ianthe's ear, knowing your desperation was naked.
"When do we leave?"
"The time has not yet come," she murmured. You looked into her shining brown-flecked eyes and were stricken with panic that the time might never come. Mercy Morn finished off another glass of wine. Teacher removed her wine glass and then, thoughtfully, removed the bottle closest to her, and then removed any bottles of wine within her reach, and she placed her tranquil oval of a face into her slender hand, and she said,
"You're wrong, Augustine. You still hate Christabel. You hated my cavalier long before what she did."
He was arrested in the process of refilling his glass. You had no idea how anyone could drink as much as the saint of patience had and remain coherent. He put down the bottle and said,
"Do I?"
God said,
"This isn't a conversation either of you have. Not now. Especially not after 5 glasses of wine."
"Lot more than 5. No.
No, it's fine. Judge ye not. Let her dig him up again, said Augustine, though now he sounded a trifle unsteady. Do I, Mercy? God help me, I don't think I do, she said.
Look me in the eyes and say that.
Augustine stood with nary a tremble. He wiped his mouth carefully with his handkerchief again, and although God had half risen too again, put his hand on Augustine's arm and looked at him, and whatever passed between them was too swift to classify, he moved next to the Saint of Joy's chair. He crouched a little, so that they were eye to eye. In the candlelight you could not tell whether you thought they looked appallingly old, or no older than Ianthe, and he said,
Joy, what's done is done. They're dead. The crime is punished. I don't hate Christabel.
Her face was savage and smooth and implacable.
Say it again, she said.
I don't hate Christabel, he said lowly. Dear, I barely hate you.
For a moment you thought you were about to see a replay of what had happened in his rooms, and that the distraction would consist of a battle between two lictors that you would have been somewhat sorry to miss. It did not. Wild-eyed, tumultuous, unbalanced, Mercy leaned in and kissed him. An alarm crescendo of horror went off in your head. She did not kiss him placidly. He responded immediately and without restraint. The lictors kissed each other in the manner of two people who either held a decided passion for one another or were attempting to slide a hidden object mouth to mouth. The saints of joy and patience kissed each other with a fervid, drunken familiarity, without preamble or, frankly, any shame. God was trying to say something. Augustine parted from Mercy Morn with a noise vaguely like a vacuum hoovering up mincemeat, and, with no crash of unholy thunder, and without the rent of the universe in twain, and without his skin melting from his unworthy bones, he turned and also kissed the Emperor of the Nine Houses. You are glued to your seat. You are hot from your temples all the way down to the top of your ribcage, with outrage and mortification vying for top place within you. You are frozen as Augustine carefully, thoughtfully, and with a great deal of intent, put his mouth on God's mouth. As though this were not fodder enough for the coming apocalypse, Mercy Morn stood swaying. One thin dress strap was sliding precariously off her shoulder. When Augustine detached from the Emperor's solemn mouth, Mercy reached up, grabbed great fistfuls of his shirt, and kissed God too. It took Ianthe two attempts to get your attention. Eventually she stood you up wholesale, and with absolutely nobody paying attention to either of you, she propelled you out of the room. You looked over your shoulder as she opened the door. God had just picked up the Saint of Joy bodily and sat her at the edge of the table, and the Saint of Patience had his mouth at God's neck, which was horrible, and Ianthe hustled you through as though escaping from a fire. You had never seen three people get their hands on one another before. You had never seen two people get their hands on each other before. Ianthe closed the door just as Augustine's fingers reached the buttons of the Emperor's shirt, and you had never been so grateful to her in your entire life.
Chapter 31
That was the cue. Your voice sounded humiliatingly high-pitched.
Harry, said Ianthe, thankfully also a trifle strangled. When three people start kissing, it is always a cue. A cue to leave.
You said, I feel unwell.
Yes. Yes, me too, she said heatedly, in unexpected accord. That was disgusting, to say the least. Old people should be shot.
The underfloor lights glowed their cool blue, trying to soothe you into circadian sleep. A cohort officer with grey tags at their sleeves lay enshrined in a niche opposite. An eyeless steel mask laid heavily on their face. Both you and Ianthe were breathing as though you had run a foot race, laboured and loud. Ianthe's hair was in long margarine tangles down her neck, and her mascara was smudged beneath her eyes, and her ribs were heaving as though she were in an asthmatic fit. She carried her high-heeled shoes in her gilded skeleton hand, and they made for a strange juxtaposition. The breath-soft lavender gauze had a tiny violet stain on the front, and her mouth was red. She had been chewing her lips, and they had broken and split. You realized, with an uneasy start, that you were both, in fact, quite drunk. Ianthe ran a tongue across those wounded lips and said, "I suppose this is it." You said, "I appreciate your part in this, Tridentarius." But before you could stop her, she drew you close with her living arm, and she bent her head to yours. You understood this inevitability only a second before it happened. Perhaps there was a dark universe in which you reached for her. In another, you exploded her heart in her chest. In this one, as she lowered her mouth, you turned your face away, and her kiss fell on the side of your jaw. Both of you reeked of alcohol. Minute traces of blood smudged your cheek with tiny perfume blots of phthalagy as she brushed her broken mouth across it with unanticipated tenderness. There was a rigid trembling somewhere in your sternum. When she raised her head again, her gaze was cool and mocking, as though your inability to receive a kiss was yet more proof of limitation. Your mouth was very dry when you said,
"My affections lie buried in the locked tomb."
"And let them lie," she said laughingly, and not very kindly. "Somebody might even exhume them for you. Good luck, Harry. Try not to die." She walked off, swinging her dancing shoes and her dead arm, and she even hummed tunelessly beneath her breath before she disappeared down the corridor, a lone wax figure in pale purple chiffon, tall and colourless, except in the greasy metal of her bone arm, which the lights rendered all the colours of the rainbow. You could hear her carefree humming even after she disappeared, as you stood outside the dining room, stock still and frozen. When it died away, you turned to your assassination. You kicked off your shoes and left them, as you were still drunk enough to find that reasonable. Most of the alcohol was already in your bloodstream, but quite a lot of it was racketing around in your small intestine. As you walked in silence down the tiled hallways, past the pillars of tendon and plex-wrapped wire, you focused on working it out of your capillaries, and then out through your pores until you were running wet with sweat. Easier to move ethanol through water membranes than anywhere else. The fog in your brain and body burnt away, and you peeled two long strands of articular cartilage and hard calcium from your exoskeleton. These you melded and worked between your hands like clay, until you had a smooth, greyish globe of bone. There was no question of proceeding by stealth. Stealth required advanced preparation, scouting, mapping, and you had not been given time for any of those. You had not known until 10 minutes before dinner that your target would be in the training room. You had been forced to come up with tactics that would work on any battlefield. The buzz of adrenaline and remnant alcohol sang through you and made you feel prickly and overwarm, despite the fact that you were as soaked with cooling sweat as though you had stood in a spray of blood. You had been the subject of attempted murder more times than you had fingers and toes. You had sat through a long, agonizing dinner, culminating in two elderly lictors getting their tongues on God. Your mouth had been very nearly kissed.
The calm that came over you as you went to murder Autus the First was the weary calm of someone who had already been tried within an inch of her fucking life. You stood before the auto door of the training room, bowered over the black lintel with rainbow-coloured bunting and tessellated butterflies of pelvises and spines. There was nothing to sense within, but you would never have been able to sense him. You pressed the obsidian tab that opened the doors. You rolled your ball through with a swift, underhand movement. You shut the doors again before they'd had the chance to part fully. You had thought this through in detail. The Saint of Duty was a Thanagy void. This you understood. Send a skeleton construct in, and within a few seconds it would be an inert pile of bone upon the floor. You had wondered about trying to build some complex mechanism with multiple layers, interlocking tiers of Thanagy-rich bone, freshly grown from your own body, forcing him to waste time chewing through it all. But then you had remembered the ease with which he had crumbled bone even as it sprouted from your wrists, and realized the risk was too great. You did not know how fast he could work, and you could not base your whole plan on a guess. When Autus the First had dried up your wrist spikes, you had felt him do it. There had been an appreciable jolt, as of a switch being thrown. He had gripped the periosteum in his hands and made something happen. That meant it was a conscious action, not passive. That was only logical, since a necromancer who automatically dispersed the Thanagy from his surroundings would be a desperate liability to his fellow adepts. If the drain was a conscious action, it required some measure of concentration. He needed to focus. You could not give him that chance. Your bomb exploded into a myriad of bone shards. You felt their Thanagy light up like an electrical impulse through the walls. You made that training room a goddamn hailstorm. Each fragment was no longer than 4 centimeters. That was long enough to kill, given the pressure with which you shattered them outward. There was a muffled eruption of rattling, a vigorous thwackater, thwackater, thwack as thousands of missiles hammered into the floor, the ceiling, the walls, the foot-thick plex window. You thumbed 2 studs out of your ears, dropped 6 full constructs behind you in a spirit of pure optimism, and slammed the pad open again. The training room was a smoking ruin. The wooden floors were a jagged carpet of embedded bone caltrops. The electrical lights overhead were smoking, crackling bars of broken housing and tungsten fibre. Your bones were cilia inside a cavity, bristling spines on a rose's stem, fine hairs on the legs of an arachnid. Razor-sharp spikes powdered harmlessly beneath your tread as you ran into that destroyed room, wearing little more than a scarf and your paint, with your collagen-coated hands clutching your 2-handed sword, and you readied yourself. The Saint of Duty wasn't there. You said, "Fuck." Then, more aggressively, "Fuck!" The smothering call of disappointment around your heart was an unhelpful distraction. You sheathed your sword to the back of your exoskeleton and, reminding yourself yet again that reliance on others was as taking a brute force blow with your vulnerable lacrimal bone, you turned off the lights and you covered the ends of the wires in a thick cap of cartilage, heading off the fire alarm. Then you removed yourself from that bone-strewn ruin, somewhat chastened, thoroughly aggrieved. Autus the First was not in the training room. Fine. He had surprised you before. There was one other place on the Mithraeum where you had found him at a time like this, when he thought he might not be disturbed. And so it was on swift feet and with rising determination that you retraced your steps toward the outer ring and the habitation atrium, and the room where 1 last lictor lay in state. The Saint of Duty was not there. Neither was the body of Kithareia the First.
A trail of blood emerged from the open doorway, smiled on dimly by the electric lights. It led away from the bier where once the necromantic saint had slept so restively. Your heart and brain responded when you bade them both be still, and for a few seconds you stood before that continuous ribbon of blood, almost without thinking. And then you retrieved them both, along with whatever madness-tattered sense you retained. You crouched. The blood was minutes old, a tangled skein of oxygen-rich carmine and oxygen-poor scarlet. Blood from the right atrium, expelled straight from the heart. You stood and stepped carefully into the room on your bare feet. Behind the abandoned altar, there was a criminal crimson splatter of blood on the back wall, more sprayed across the incorrupt petals of the increasingly blush roses. And discarded on the floor lay Ortis's spear, slick and red from its point to almost halfway down its shaft. You did not need a sixth house dust botherer to reconstruct this particular tableau. Someone had stood behind the bier, their back to the wall,